We get on the phone line and welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
What's up, Kimball?
Well, I know we're going to talk children's entertainment today, but before we get to that, I want to chat a little bit about the Red Sox. To paraphrase you, quite a staff Heim Bloom has put together, isn't it?
Who's had the best outing, the best starting outing so far? It's not Kluber, but he's close. Who knew that opening day start for him was going to be the gold standard for these, nice to see my guy, our guy. He's our guy, right, for sale?
Oh, my God.
His thing, and then talk a lot after about how upset he is, and who was the the converted reliever, and then the other game. And last night, you're hitting three home runs in the bottom of the first inning, and it's launching pad, and you think, yes. 3-1, 750 winning percentage. But no.
Well, that's okay. Nick Pivetta's going tonight, so anything's possible. But you never know with Pivetta. He could throw six no-hit innings, or he could be gone in the second.
Nick Pivetta, the modern-day Al Nipper. Right?
Yes, Nipper. Yes.
Because every now and again, he's okay. And you think that went pretty well. And then a few starts happen, and you go to Baseball Reference, and it's no wonder that he has a career ERA of, last time I checked, 5.02. You're getting up there, Mr. Kimball, when you nudge over the five. That's a big number, I feel like. So who knows? Maybe they can win 8-6, but at least the offense is going well. Adam Duvall doing his thing. And I looked at that home run again from that unlikely game the other day, and you had mentioned Rico Petrocelli type of swing. I see that. If you're a right-handed hitter and you hit the low ball at Fenway Park and can just yank it over that wall, you can hit 30 to 35 home runs on the season. Fisk was a low ball hitter.
Mm.
He would just go down. That game six home run in the 75 World Series, that was below the knees. And he just yanked it out. And Duvall seems to be doing that. He has that kind of uppercut, go down and get it sort of swing. So I wasn't expecting. In that first game, he looked terrible in the bottom of the ninth with a chance to do something. And I thought, oh, man, this guy sucks too. But it was good early returns on him.
And the Red Sox seem to be defying the pitch clock, because when you give up 7, 8, 9 runs a game and walk half a dozen people, it doesn't matter how quickly people are working if they throw 150 pitches.
You know what's annoying about that is it arms the idiots. And idiots,
yes,
are always,
yes,
attempting to arm themselves because, see, what was I telling you? It's not the game it used to be. The pitch clock, it doesn't even make a difference. Yeah, 20 minutes. Because they don't understand when there are 20 men crossing the plate and the Red Sox are saying, Let's walk a baker's dozen today. Let's just go for it. Let's walk everybody. And you have the pitch clock it's huge. That number, the 26 minutes that shaved off of games during spring training, this is something, it's baffling to me that people don't understand what this means. It's potentially a sports saver. I don't know how else to put it. It's really all that can bring baseball back and make it resemble a sport that people who are just, you ever talk to someone and you have a succession of points to go through and you say the first thing and it's just supposed to be the start and we're going to move through the rest of it. But they're, never thought of it that way. And they're gone. You've just lost them.
Yeah.
You can't go through the rest of the points. You can sort of try, but they're just going to go, because they're so captivated with that first point. That's how people think about sports. Sports, as I've said before, it's not War and Peace. It's not Proust. It should be relatively easy, and especially with the numbers. The numbers tell you, they tell me, that Dave Kingman deserves his shot at Cooperstown. And I can make a statistical case, just like if the Bruins right now, I can make a statistical case that they've bettered the Montreal Canadiens of 76-77, because I can look at who Montreal was beating, the Detroit Red Wings and all that stuff. And the Bruins were beating much better teams. Anyone can go out there and do that, but people, no. They just want to say what they want to say. Told you, wrecked the purity of the game.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Let's talk about some children's entertainment and some interesting things that you've picked out for us to discuss. First of all, Arnold LaBelle's wonderful books and the films based on the Frog and Toad stories. Love them.
Oh, aren't they awesome? Did you enjoy these growing up? Did you share these with the youth, the boy, the kids from the classes?
Yeah, you know, I came to a little bit late in life, and it was, maybe a decade or so ago when I directed a musical version of the books, A Year with Frog and Toad, and just fell in love with the story and the characters. And yeah, now the boy has heard them and watched and likes them too. But yeah, they're such wonderful characters, and they're sweet stories, but not at all cloying. They're fun animals to hang out with.
They're witty. They're for adults. I'm an adult, and I love them. And I think they are... Toad is so strange. He's such a weird guy. The frog is... The root of the story, it was really just a frog and a toad who are friends. And anyone who has a friend or has ever had a friend can identify with their friendship. That's what Holmes and Watson are. It is really the same, except they're amphibians. And they don't solve as many crimes. But sometimes Sherlock Holmes wasn't that great at solving crimes, and it was really about him and Watson hanging out and being buddies. So there is an animated incarnation of the characters and their stories, what we would, I guess, now call claymation kind of art from the 1980s. And so I can just watch it whenever. If it's time to go to bed and I just want to look at something that's not going to upset me like the rest of the day, I can just watch these guys do their thing. Like there's one episode, for instance, where it's springtime, like it is now, and Toad has had a nice sleep and Frog is ready to go. He's very upbeat, Frog. He's sort of the less tempestuous one, I'd say, in the friendship, whereas... Toad broods, and Frog is excited. He goes over to Toad's house, and Toad doesn't want to get up. He's like, come back in whatever, June. He doesn't want to deal with it. So Frog has to find a way to trick him to get up by manipulating the clock. And there's another one, too, that really just epitomizes how weird Toad is. Toad is just one of the strangest people, really, in real life or fiction that I've ever encountered, and he's awesome. And he has these seeds, and the seeds won't grow. And Frog is saying, you have to sort of, I don't know, talk to them, like make friends with them or something. So he's out there like in the middle of the night, and he's singing to the seeds and everything. And he's like this deep sort of bass voice. Well, he's a toad. And it's just, he's so into it. And I personally like people and amphibians who are into things. And people tend not to be into things. And whatever this duo is doing, if they're having a picnic or they're biking or they're hanging out or they're growing seeds or whatever it might be, they're passionate about it once they get, especially Toad, once Toad gets going. Frog is, he's always up for everything. So I think it's wonderful for children. It's wonderful for adults. It's wonderful for children because it stresses the importance of friendship. Friendship is the root of everything. Friendship is the root of anything significant, really. It's the root of art. Art is created so that people can partake of something that helps them. That's a gesture of friendship. And it's useful for adults because it reminds us that we should never stop using our imagination. And we should never lose our capacity for play. Because when we do that, we just become these human calluses. And that's just most people. You need to be able to see the joy in this, and you need to be able to locate at least what the concept of joy is in your own life.
Well, and that's why, and you've said this before on the air with us, you've said it in your writing and in the journal too. I think there's an openness with children that you just don't get with a lot of older people who get calloused, who get that hardness and don't want to let the world in. And children are still open to possibility.
You know what I was thinking about today? Because when Frog and Toad come up now, predictably, in our times, people try to, they just want to use something for whatever they want to use it for. They don't want it to be what it is. And even if they were told definitively that it was this one thing and they wanted to be something else, they're going to emphasize that latter thing. And so when you read about Toad and Frog now, it's usually about their their allegedly gay relationship because they're two male amphibians. And I thought, you know what? That's missing the point. The point isn't that it might be liberating for someone who is gay or something like that. It's liberating in that I'm here talking about it with you, that I have. It's just one example. No compunction. Here's this guy who knows all the hockey and the baseball and everything, and he's not a child, and he's just talking about his love for this program, and it would never enter my mind not to do that. So I'm almost, in a way, coming from the place they're coming from. Now, my father, for instance, was my late father, a very good person and sort of stoic in some ways. If he was alive now and he heard the segment we were doing, he'd say good job and things like that. But he just would never have had an interest like this. It would just be completely unimaginable that he would say, well, Frog and Toad, that's really good. I still like checking these out. So I just think that's the value of it. It encourages you to never make the mistake of not being yourself. And when people worry about being something else, that's when they run into problems with, well, first and foremost, with themselves. So this is, when I say lovingly that Toad is weird, that's what I mean. I mean, Toad's cool, too, at the same time. Frog really digs Toad. Toad is the guy that you want to know.
Well said. Absolutely. Colin Fleming talking with us here on Downtown. I was not familiar with The Railway Children, which apparently has been adapted a number of times, but only this 1968 version from the BBC still exists out there.
Yeah, a lot of these things, they get wiped. And it was a radio adaptation too, and that was on Children's Hour, which we've talked about via Carlton Hobbs and Sherlock Holmes and Norman Shelley. That aired sometimes, not every time. It was also on the Light program, but it aired on Children's Hour too. And The Railway Children was it's based on the book by Edith Nesbit, and Nesbit, she wrote a horror story called Man, Size, and Marble that I actually talked about in my Scrooge book. So this is quite a turnaround for her to be doing this story about this family that relocates. There's a subgenre of English children's and young adult fiction where people are displaced and they go to country estates that are around, have been around for a long time. And so the estate and the house and the grounds and all of the imagination interlaced with all of that, those things become characters unto themselves. And we have the family dynamic. In this particular, in The Railway Children, we have a father who is wrongfully accused of something and, in fact, imprisoned for it. So part of the story is about gaining his liberation, which is achieved with a kindly old gentleman who himself is almost displaced into their family and becomes this wise source of counsel for everybody.
Yeah, it was very well done. I enjoyed that a lot. I was so glad to see, because I hadn't read any of her books in a while, the adaptation from 1986 of one of Lucy M. Boston's stories, Children of Green Knowe, and she's the patron saint of late bloomers. I think most of her work was published fairly late in life.
Yeah, and it's again the same kind of idea of in the first of the books. So this is like really the one that the 86 adaptation is based on. This kid named Toesland is going to his great grandmother's, and this is an even older house estate. It's from like the time of the Norman Conquest, the sort of history that we don't have here in the United States. And it has this outstanding set piece to begin, where this kid is journeying to this mysterious place to be with this person that he doesn't really know. And there are these local floods. And we see floods in things like The Woman in Black, Flooded Grounds plays such a supernatural, spooky role. And he has to essentially ferry to get to this out of the way estate, and the characters are going to be, I love this kind of mashup. They're going to be these ghosts of dead relatives that, of course, you never met. And some of the ghosts, and this is a neat twist, they age. They don't just stay, because we think of ghosts as your ghost. You're frozen in your whatever ghostly state you arrived in, or however the rules work. But we don't think of transformation. So it's warming, but it's also spooky, and it's this journey for this young person. And again, it's just so rife with, and not just imagination, but these imagination inducers for everyone else. Don't you want to go out there and find wonder? And when you're walking home at night, don't you want to think up little stories in your head of what could be going on in that house over there, or on that barge that you see somewhere out in the harbor? And it's just a way of thinking that it adds to your life. So these programs, I find them so much more engrossing than anything that else that I see. I mean, I love, for instance, Night Court when I was growing up. Night Court's on now, but it's really just a remake. It's just the comfort food. There's nothing there to partake of. There's no substance. And substance doesn't mean something that's going to be unwieldy and weighty and, oh, it's like homework. The time just flies by. You don't even know what's happened when you watch these things. You sit down, you think, I'll watch an episode. Boom, it's 3 hours later.
And I think the thread that runs through all of these is that they never talk down to children.
No, and adults don't have to come down to them.
Right.
That's the key part, too. I never watch things like this and think, well, I'm not getting enough out of this. And my whole existence is art. Is the creation of art, and I'm on these rarefied levels all the time. That's the brilliance of works like this, that they hit those different age groups and demographics. And there are things, for instance, in them that a child will get and enjoy a lot and laugh over. But at the same time, there are things that a child will not get that as an adult you think, oh, wow, that's good. That it's almost as if it's time delayed for your age when you get to it. And when you think about how would you make something like that, you realize that there's just this sublime talent behind it. This is not coincidence or happenstance. It doesn't just happen on its own. This is real skill and dedication and vision, and I'd say most of all, understanding what matters. And the wit in these programs, the wit is as rich as anything. If you were to read some description of Charles Dickens in the Pickwick Papers, and it's so that Dickensian wit was immediately on display from the first novel, the wit is of no lesser a degree of achievement in many of these programs. And so they're for children, yes, but that's just an easy kind of classification. For instance, let me put it this way. If children didn't exist and it was just people over a certain age, these things would have equal validity as works to partake of.
A lot of wit and imagination and creativity, too, in the 1974 series Bagpuss, the best old cloth cat I think I've ever seen.
What we would here call a stuffed animal, and it's these programs, they also exist within this liminal between state. And Bagpuss came out in the mid-70s, 1974. There was 13 episodes, and it's about this cloth or stuffed animal cat, and this kind of a non sequitur that starts with this little girl has a store. Well, how does a little girl have a store? But we just accept it because it's cool, it's neat. And the store doesn't so much as sell things as she's found items, toys, beloved keepsakes that used to belong to people. And she sets them up in a store for if people walk by and they recognize something that once belonged to them that they missed, they can come in and just claim it. I mean, it's a great idea it's touching. I mean, someone who cares about people thinks of an idea like that. It's not self-serving. And that doesn't mean you can't make money with it or something like that, but there's a good person behind that. And so there are all these sepia kind of prints at the beginning, and it looks olden times and throwback and Edwardian or whatever it is. And then this stuffed animal cat, the cloth cat, Bagpuss, he wakes up, and he's very skilled. He's a lyrical poet sometimes. And once he wakes up, these other items and animals, there are these very cute little mice.
Oh, I love the mice. They're great.
they're sort of the high, squeaky voice Greek chorus,
yes.
And the manual labor of the undertaking. And there's this sort of, there's this bookend bird, woodpecker, who's going to be, he's kind of dickish, but he's a good guy at the same time. And there's a toad with a banjo who has some great songs, and a girl doll. And the shows revolve around some item that they all discover that's new to the shop. And it's almost this presentation of what that item is. But it becomes this whole story, and this the wit of this. I mean, it's Booth Tarkington wrote, I've mentioned before, these novels, Penrod in 17. And I had them in mind when I was writing Meathead Say the Realest Things, because they were the funniest novels I've ever read. And so I looked at it as kind of competition. And they were these novels ostensibly for young adults. But you could live 100 lifetimes as an adult and think that they are hilarious. And Bagpuss puts me in that sort of like frame of mind. Is in the right from the first episode with a ship in a bottle, and they don't understand how it's in the bottle, and Bagpuss is saying how would you go anywhere in this ship? It's in the bottle. Are you going to get anywhere? He just seems very logical about it, because he's identifying it as this ocean-going craft. He doesn't understand that its role is decorative. So the bird is like, why don't you just sing a magical song, and we'll see how that goes. Maybe you can get it out of the bottle. So it becomes like this this Lear-esque, crossed with Tennyson, ballad of this ship with little like sort of midshipman mice and this cutaway and everything. And I'm thinking, as I was watching this, I'm thinking, like, who, if you didn't like this, it to me would be such an indictment on your heart and your soul. I would think, like, what would have to be you'd have to have something happen to you that you couldn't overcome, that seared and scarred you and compromised you.
And finally, man, I love this show. I had never seen it before, but it was terrific. A show from the early 80s called Maggie, about a Scottish girl. It reminded me of some coming-of-age shows here, My So-Called Life, which I thought was terrific as well. But, wow, what a great character, a great cast. Doris Roberts from Everybody Loves Raymond, and friend of downtown, the great James Hampton.
Yeah, this is just one of the best television programs ever made, I believe. It was short running. We're in 1981 and 1982. We're in Glasgow. And the title character is a 17-year-old young woman with ambitions not to just drop out of school and be a teenage bride. And have you ever seen such... It's not a slum. But have you ever seen such a lived-in TV show?
Mm.
You think about something like All in the Family and that sort of blue collar. But they live in an apartment that, as a character says, looks like it's like a prison, and it's a dirty Glasgow. It's not it's not always in Glasgow, but that's where it's primarily based. And she's feeling these pressures from home, and she has this kind of quasi-boyfriend in Edinburgh, whose family is more eccentric and affluent, and she has a brother and a sister who the brother is a footballer, and that's really all he cares about. And her sister is like a lot of her peers and girls she knows, and that all she wants to do is get married. And it really is it's high level theater. I suppose now it's something that we would call a dramedy, a cross between drama and comedy, but that doesn't really, it's more than that. For instance, there's an episode where they're at the home and up on the 10th floor or whatever they live on in this sort of tenement block. And Maggie has been trying to talk her father and her uncle into striking out on their own in the plumbing business and to stop working for other people. And maybe they could move to somewhere nicer. And she's the one who goes around and looks at potential shop fronts and that kind of thing. She's really the brains of the family. And they get this telegram, and it's that her grandmother is sick, and they don't know what it means. There's nothing else in the telegram. And if you're a sharp observer, you're thinking that's because it charges by the word, and none of these people have any money. And so her sort of quasi-boyfriend is visiting for that period, and they go off to check on the grandmother. And so we go from Glasgow to, it's called the Glen, and it's just the most beautiful scenery you've ever seen on the smaller, the big screen, and to see this old woman, she's 83 years old. It's one of the best episodes of anything I've ever seen. And it's just talking with her and interacting with her. I mean, it's stunning. This mostly forgotten show that, I mean, how many people in the world, how many people in the States can even know this show? I bet you it's less than 50. It's probably less than 20. And that's just one of the best episodes, like I said, of anything I've, it is, I don't mean to like insult anyone here, but it's shockingly good. It really is astounding that this show is as good as it is, because you just wouldn't think that. It's art. I mean, it's really legitimate art.
Well, and as somebody who works with teenagers, it's so realistic. And Maggie's dialogue, her worldview, it's absolutely perfect. So whoever was doing the writing, it must have known something about 15, 16-year-old kids, because they nailed it.
Oh, the cadences of kids, too. Mm. The rhythms of kids. The randomness of kids sometimes, but it's a kind of predictable randomness. Like before I came on, I was at the Starbucks and getting a green tea and just kind of decompressing from some things. And these kids came in and they were a little bit younger than someone like Maggie. And they're just going to make a certain amount of noise. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's not noise that other people make. It's the scratch of the chairs constantly because they can't sit still. And they have all of that energy and anxiety because they're trying to impress each other and see where they stand with each other. And they have these things that mean certain things to them of the utmost importance, even though in 2 weeks' time they might not even remember them at all. And there's just a different noise that follows kids around. So when Maggie is visiting the quasi-boyfriend's family and she's sharing the room with his sister, she's in one bed and the sister slash friend is in this other bed, and the sister slash friend just wants to tell Maggie about this boy she's enamored with. And the rhythms of the conversation is Maggie falls asleep because she's traveled and she can't stay up. And the disappointment of the friend that she doesn't have this audience, and you can feel her kind of, not like a huge tragic thing, but you feel her disappointment and her doubt and her pain because she's not really getting support from her family and she doesn't have an outlet for this. And it's one of those crushing kind of Phil Spector teenage symphony moments in the bedroom right before bed.
All wonderful entertainment, and you do not have to be a child, but you got to have an open mind and heart, but you'll love all of them that we talked about this afternoon. Colin, thanks as always. Look forward to next week. We talk about the films, the work of Leo McCarey.
Oh, good. I was writing about him today, so that will be handy.
Excellent. We'll talk with you next week.
All right. Sounds good.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown.